Yes. Okay. Chapter 22, International Monetary Organizations, Part 2. And again, we have the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And a man saying, the IMF is working to alleviate poverty.
Then we got debt of 53% of GNP.
The world is totally in debt. But they're working to alleviate poverty. That's what they tell us.
Yeah.
Ann, why don't you read the themes?
One, primary importance of the money power, the power to create money and regulate it. Two, these are the themes of lost science of money. Two, the nature of money purposely kept secret and confused.
Oops, sorry.
Three, how a society defines money determines who controls a society. Four, battle over control of money has raged for millennia, public versus private. Five, the misuse of the monetary system causes tremendous misery and suffering for the ordinary people. That's Will and Martin, February 2014. Whenever the public has owned a significant fraction of the money power, great public benefit has ensued, such as Sparta, the Roman Republic, the American colonies in the 18th century, greenbacks after the Civil War, Canada after the Great Depression, British experience after World War II, and that's Martin.
Okay. And here are the parts of today's presentation. We're going to start 1971. This is really the end of Bretton Woods, but the IMF continues. And we're going to talk about the IMF. Speculators undermine the IMF. The floating rates. The IMF's money creation powers, their reserves, and the IMF's money creation powers, their quotas, including SDRs. The question of the IMF's unfair conditionality. Then we're going to talk about the World Bank, started in Bretton Woods in 1944, and its focus on free trade. And then we're going to talk about the World Bank and Third World Debt. And then the debt money system drives free trade. And we'll look specifically at the World Bank, IMF, and private commercial banks, all of which have to do with this free trade that we're all experiencing. The World Bank affiliates. In 1956, the IFC, International Finance Corporation, and 1960, the IDA, International Development Association. And then we'll talk a little about the Islamic monetary developments. And Stephen defines it as echoes of scholasticism from the Middle Ages, which was a moral economic analysis. And then a summary. And Stephen's point is it is U.S. monetary reform that is needed. So that's what's in today's class. Will, do the first one.
1971, end of Bretton Woods, but IMF continues. Speculators undermine the IMF.
Will, let me stop you there. Do you remember from last week what Nixon did in 1971?
Took us off the gold standard.
Right, okay. So that's where we're at right now here.
Okay. Zarlinga, Los Angeles Money, page 614, he says, by the IMF's reckoning, large capital flows by major speculators severely harmed the system, which had been designed not for their speculative gains, but to facilitate production and trade between nations. And then Margaret De Beers, the IMF's official historian, said, the extreme volatility of capital flows, example, 2,000 billion in 1976, in response to interest rate differences or anticipation of exchange rate changes, was in large part responsible for undermining the international monetary order that existed until the late 1960s. And then you have two books, the International Monetary Fund, 1972 to 1978, Cooperation on Trial, Volume 2, Narrative and Analysis by Margaret G. DeVries. Okay. And then you have one of her books called Balance of Payments Adjustments, 1945 to 1986, the IMF Experience.
Yeah, remember last week when Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard, the impact of that, according to Robotham, the author Robotham, was one of the most significant events in the history of money, because no longer did any country have to worry that someone was going to bring their currency and demand gold anymore. So that opened up the spigots of money creation around the world. And
I got Robotham's book.
Right, in Robotham's book. And at the same time, the countries started removing the control of the money, their money leaving their country and going internationally for international trading and speculation. So all of that was happening in the early 70s, which really wiped out the old Bretton Woods system and leaves us with what we have today, with all these financial markets with huge amounts of money being moved around the world and causing extreme harm to the ordinary person.
So money has just become a commodity in itself and traded. Is that right?
Well, as gold and silver, it was always a commodity. but now, think of a country like, say, in Asia, that had foreign investment, had moved money in there, right? And then those foreign investors decided, you know, I can make more money in this other country. So they pull out their millions of dollars, leaving that the country that had it invested in decimated.
Yeah.
You know, that's because there's no capital controls. The money can just go all over the world, you know, move around. And it's a terrible system. It's horrible. And it all started with that Nixon taking us off the gold standard, which at least with that, countries had to worry that they couldn't print too much money because they had to have a gold for it, and they kept their money under their control in their country. But that all went away, you know? It all went away. Yeah. And do the next one.
1971, end of Bretton Woods, but IMF continues. Speculators undermine the IMF. Now, Zarlinga says, the early 1970s were a critical moment for the IMF. Which would take precedence? The ability of corporate or other speculators to shift huge amounts of capital overnight without warning in order to take advantage of a 1/20% interest rate differential between currencies, or the ability of producers to create and trade goods upon which the world's peoples depended.
What was the IMF going to do? Hit enter, Will.
What?
Hit enter.
Oh.
It surrendered without a fight, subjecting its operations to the notion that free markets in currency and interest rate speculation take precedence over all else.
There you go. Okay. I'll do the next one. 1971, end of Bretton Woods, but the IMF continues. Speculators undermine the IMF. Stephen Zarlenga proposes the following to reduce speculators' manipulation of national currencies. One, place a small tax on speculative currency transactions, but this won't stop large currency manipulations. Two, identify currencies that are vulnerable. For example, Southeast Asia during the 1997 crisis, and allow no short selling or allow only low positions. Number three, settle futures and forward currency contracts in kind, not in cash. If speculators have to buy back the physical currency rather than settle in dollars, their purchases push the price of the currency back up and they could get caught losing money. And here's a picture there of exchange rates on the lower left. And in the center, the currency futures and options markets. There's a lot of websites about that. Learn how to trade in them, make a lot of money. And on the right, the Asian crisis, what's highlighted in orange are the countries that were affected, whose economy was affected in the Asian crisis of 1997. You can see the Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Philippines, and South Korea. And that was because of all the capital manipulation of money around the world, the speculation with investing money. And they pulled out of these Asian countries very suddenly, left them. A lot of unemployed and bankruptcies and everything. We'll do the next one.
Floating rates. From March 1973, exchange rates of various major industrial currencies floated, with smaller currencies pegged to larger ones. From the IMF annual 1973 annual report, February the 12th, March 9, the United States informed the fund that the president, was requesting that the Congress authorize proposal to the fund of a 10% reduction in the par value of the U.S. dollar. The fund concurred in the new par values proposed by Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, Yugoslavia, and by the United Kingdom for Bahamas and Bermuda. The fund noted new central rates communicated by Bolivia, the Republic of China, the Dominican Republic, Ecuador, Finland, Greece, Haiti, Iceland, Israel, Jamaica, Nepal, the Netherlands, Antilles, Nigeria, Panama, Portugal, Suriname, Sweden, Turkey, and Zaire. The fund noted the circumstances that led Japan temporarily to allow the yen to flow, and Italy temporarily not to maintain exchange rates for the lira in the official market within announced limits.
So this is an example of floating exchange rates, which were changing. And do the next one.
1971, end of Bretton Woods, but IMF continues. Lending to its troubled members became the IMF's primary activity in the second half of the 1970s, especially to the U.S. and Britain. And that IMF's money creation powers reserves.
Okay, so this is, they've gone into lending money. And now we're going to look at reserves. Why don't you do the next one?
Did you say?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Originally, this is from Zarlenga. Originally, the primary money creation mechanism of the IMF was the use of dollars as a reserve on which other currencies were created. U.S. balance of payments deficits could fuel monetary creation in countries such as Germany, which obtained the dollar reserves through foreign trade surpluses. But this was an automatic structural feature, not a discretionary power. And now over here we see composition of reserves, end of period 1960, first quarter 1970, and in billions of U.S. dollars. And international reserves, okay, 1961 to 1970, we see,
so this is foreign exchange.
Yeah, the gold.
Gold. SDRs. I don't see SDRs yet. Oh, here's SDRs. A little bit.
Tiny, tiny.
Because they just started 1969, right. So you see a little tiny bit on the right. Reserves of the country's money. It's, I guess, that kind of beige, right? And this is foreign exchange. So the reserves in the 60s, the IMF reserves, were made up of various things. Each country would give some gold, starting in 69, they'd have some SDRs, their own currency. They would give some of their own currency, and they would also give other countries' currencies that they had, which they consider foreign reserves to them.
Yeah.
And that would, each country was to give a certain amount. And that was the reserves for the IMF. Okay. I'm not sure if I understood all of that. So how is that money creation power reserves? He's saying it's just more a structural feature that they had these reserves and dollars as a reserve could be used to create other currencies. Okay. So dollars went out of the U.S. during the 60s to buy war materials for Vietnam, and they went over to Europe, and the Europeans used them to create their currencies because it was a reserve.
Yeah.
Okay, now I understand it, I think. Okay. The IMF's money creation powers member quotas as a loan fund. Okay, so quotas are different from reserves. Okay. The IMF can also create limited liquidity, or money, by extending loans to members. The source of the money or the funds are the reserve quotas that the members deposit with the IMF. Countries in trouble can borrow up to three times their quota. However, from 1982, the members limited the total amount that could be loaned out to 60% of the total of all IMF's reserves. So I'm a little confused, the difference between reserves and quotas. But here's the member quotas as a loan fund. In millions of US dollars, and this is the source, is the 2014 annual report of the IMF. And you can see, and this is in millions of dollars, the quotas that each country, they had to keep at the IMF. And supposedly this would be used as a loan fund for countries who needed IMF loans.
They can borrow up to three times their quota.
Yeah, three times their quota. So China has 550 million in U.S. worth in U.S. dollars, and I guess they could borrow up to 1.5.
Well, and then, but
billion.
Then from 1982, they limited the total amount to be loaned out to 60%
of all reserves.
Okay. Yeah.
So you can see the developed countries have very high quotas, like France, the United Kingdom. Look at the United States.
United States.
2750. So that's $2,750,000,000. India has 400 million. Okay. So this was the loan fund. We'll do the next one.
Okay. IMF's money creation powers, member quotas as loan fund. IMF quota review, 2014 annual report of IMF. Quotas and governance, review of quotas. When a country joins the IMF, it is assigned an initial quota based on a formula that helps assess a member's relative position in the world economy. The IMF's Board of Governors conducts general quota reviews at regular intervals of not more than 5 years. Any changes in quotas must be approved by an 85% majority of its voting powers, and a member's quota cannot be changed without its consent.
Okay. And do the next one.
From Robotham, the IMF presents itself as a financial pool, an international reserve of money built up with contributions, known as quotas, from subscribing nations, that is, most nations of the world. However, credit creation accompanies almost every aspect of IMF funding. Yeah, so Robotham, this is from his book, Goodbye America, published in 2000. Now, he's 25% of each nation's IMF quota is paid in the form of gold. This is the only component of the IMF money creating powers that does not create new debt.
Right, so I guess the reserves and the quotas are the same, right? See, there's reserves, and then a quota is how much of a reserve each individual company country has to have at the IMF. So here's the gold part of the reserve. Yeah. Remember, yeah, we had this thing here. This,
right.
What makes up the reserve is gold. The reserves in the fund of the country, and then there are foreign exchange that they have.
Yeah.
Right. So.
So it's not only gold; it's other things.
Yeah, the country's own money and other countries' money that country has and puts in the reserve at the IMF.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll do the next one. This is also Robotham. Number two, his second point. The 75% of a nation's quota payable in national currency, not gold, but national currency, is today invariably funded by the government concerned through the sale of bonds, thus adding to the nation's national debt. This involves the sale of government bonds to commercial banks, leading to money creation by those banks. This source of revenue forms the main fund of IMF monies available to developing nations. So it always goes back to commercial banks making money out of thin air and putting the governments in debt. And there you can see the Federal Reserve, the total U.S. public debt, starting around 1970, when we went off the gold standard, and it just is up, 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 up. But that's happening to all the countries. Yeah. We'll do the next one.
Yes.
Is that why he called his book Goodbye America?
Yes, yes.
Killing ourselves.
Oh my God.
Okay, B, IMF's money creation powers, member quota as a loan fund. Robotham says, the IMF presents itself as a financial pool, an international reserve of money built up with contributions, known as quotas. from subscribing nations, that is, most nations of the world. However, credit creation accompanies almost every aspect of IMF funding. Number three, Will Bottom, Goodbye America, page 101. In 1979, the IMF instituted special drawing rights, SDRs. These SDRs were avowedly created as an international monetary currency, international currency. Although they are credited to each nation's account with the IMF, if a nation borrows these SDRs, defined in dollars, it must repay this amount or pay interest on the loan. SDRs are actually a credit facility, just like a bank overdraft. If they are borrowed, they must be repaid. Thus, IMF is now creating and issuing money created in parallel with the equivalent debt. The IMF reserve being the original pool of quota funds. And then, on IMF.org, the SDR is an international reserve asset created by the IMF in 1969 to supplement its member countries' official reserves. Its value is based on a basket of four key international currencies, and SDRs can be exchanged for freely usable currencies. As of March 17, 2015, 204 billion SDRs were created and allocated to members, equivalent to about $280 billion.
So they're created by the IMF, credited, you know, a bookkeeping entry, and if they're borrowed, they'll have to be paid back. So they're used as a debt money. Everything is debt.
Yes.
And do the next one.
IMF's money creation powers, member quotas as loan fund. The IMF presents itself as a financial pool. Here we have a talking again about Robotham's book, an international reserve of money built up with contributions, known as quotas, from subscribing nations, that is, most nations of the world. However, credit creation accompanies almost every aspect of IMF funding. And here we are from Goodbye America. The quota demands by the IMF have reached a point where so-called creditor nations, such as America and Britain, are reluctant to undertake yet more bond issues and further national debt to supplement these funds.
To supply these funds.
Oh, to supply.
Yes.
Therefore, in recent years, the IMF has begun to circumvent the restrictions of its overall quota. The IMF administers loan packages made up in part from its own quotas and in part from commercial sources. For example, of the $56 billion loan advanced under the auspices of the IMF to South Korea in the wake of the Asian crisis, only $20 billion was actually contributed by the fund itself, the remaining $36 billion being arranged by direct cooperation with international commercial banks who created money for the purpose.
Yep. Loan packages now.
Yeah.
The IMF has loaned out so much, they don't want to keep loaning it out, right? So they're turning and saying, well, the commercial banks will help us with their, you know, with a loan package.
The cartoon. IMF is placidly standing there while this other guy is flying off the edge of the cliff.
One of the debtor nations.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all debt and loans. How they expect? Well, this goes back to the original happening of Bretton Woods. How they expect nations who are having trouble with their trade deficits to borrow their way out of it? This doesn't work.
Yeah.
Doesn't work. I'll do the next one. E, question of the IMF, unfair conditionality. The IMF, and this is Stephen Zarlenga, the IMF has come under some of its harshest criticism and engaged in some of its most questionable actions in the area of conditionality, the terms it sets for the debtor nation to receive assistance. And you see a cartoon called Structural Adjustment, and the IMF Coast Guard is on the left, and the IMF personnel is saying, to keep from sinking faster, throw your luggage overboard. And the developing nations are coming in a boat, the poor developing nations, and they're sinking, and in order to sink slower, they should throw baggage overboard, but they're still sinking.
And there's the mouse trap. You know, a bag of money?
That's right.
Come, get your money.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
That's right. That is right. Exactly right. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's... Yes. We'll do the next one.
Okay. A question is still on unfair conditionality. Crisis in South Korea, the bailout, the bailout package of loans worth $55 billion is set for Korea. That's in the New York Times in 1997. Government officials and private analysts predicted that the severe cuts in public spending and other austerity moves would cause unemployment to double or even triple in a land where lifetime employment has long been taken for granted. Bankruptcies already running at high rates are expected to skyrocket. Some economists said it would be 2 years or more before the economy hadn't recovered yet. Among the other elements of the proposal is a requirement that South Korea drop some of its trade barriers and that the government pass for legislation making the central bank independent of government control. Oh, wow.
Yep.
It's a full takeover by the private banks.
That's right. There you go. That's one of the conditionalities.
Yeah.
If South Korea wants a loan from the IMF, they have to do all these things.
Yeah.
Give up their public central bank. And do the next one.
Question of the IMF, unfair conditionality. Zarlenga said, when lesser developed countries needed bailing out of loans improperly advanced to them by the world's largest private banks, the IMF has served to bail out the bankers, generally shifting their costly errors onto the average citizen of the member states. Well, of course, why not? Now, commercial banks and the International Monetary Fund, an empirical analysis by Thomas Oatley, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, July 2002. And he says, the analysis suggests that there is a robust positive relationship between the size of a developing country's commercial bank debt and the size of the loan it receives from the IMF, even after we control for other forms of debt and for a number of other factors likely to influence the size of the IMF loan. However, there is considerable cross-national variation in this relationship. Commercial banks based in the US, Germany, Switzerland, and Britain have been very successful at the IMF, while commercial banks based in France and Japan have been substantially less successful.
So what he's saying is, if a developing country has a loan from a commercial bank in Germany or the US, it's more likely for them to get an IMF loan in order to pay back the banks.
Yeah.
But if the developing country has a loan from, say, Japan or France, they might not get a loan from the IMF. So the commercial banks in countries like the US, Germany, Switzerland, and Britain will in effect be backed by the IMF. The IMF will give loans to the developing country so that the developing country can keep paying back their loan to the commercial banks. It's just real sweetheart deals all around, you know. So that's why Zarlanga was saying the IMF has served to bail out the bankers.
Yeah.
And this man did a study on it.
I guess that's what they were talking about when they said that Greece really has to pay back Goldman Sachs, or somebody has to pay back Goldman Sachs.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Will, why don't you do the next one?
Still on the question of the IMF and fair conditionality. Brazil, 1982 through 83, according to Azarlingo, in the Brazilian bailouts, the IMF insisted on cutting Brazil's public expenditure by 50% from 1982 to 1983, and then another 50% in 1985. Imagine the effect of cutting 75% of public expenditures in America, Germany, or Switzerland in 4 years.
Mm. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
But they do that to a developing country.
Yeah. Wow. Ghana, in 2015, on the Ghana web, July the 8th, 2015, this is a current article.
IMF
bailout, 2,000 nurses, midwives, jobless. Mm-hmm. Minister of Health, Alexio, whatever his name is, the dream of over 2,000 qualified nurses and midwives to be offered jobs after successfully completing national service seems to be fizzling into thin air as the International Monetary Fund's conditionality of reducing the public sector wage bill to a tax revenue to about 35% ties government's hands for fresh employment.
Wow.
Checks by the finder indicate that the Ministry of Health has written to the Ministry of Finance and Economic Planning for clearance to employ over 2,000 qualified nurses and midwives. But the Ministry of Finance and Economic Planning says there is no money.
Something that country could definitely use, right?
Yes.
Nurses and midwives to help people? My goodness.
2,000. Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
Something is rotten.
Very much. I'll do the next one. This is Zarlanga, and the italics are his. The danger arises when reasonableness, proportionality, and balance are cast aside, where the basic purpose of the monetary system is subverted to a near sociopathic greed, where under cover of one ideology or another, currency institutions and mechanisms upon which the livelihood of millions of people depends are destroyed without a second thought. That must be stopped. It is a form of cannibalism. And that's what it is.
Putting the world through the meat grinder.
Yeah. Yeah. Anne, do the next one.
The World Bank came out of the same conflict at Bretton Woods as the IMF. The World Bank is also known as the IBRD, International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. The bank's first loans were extended during the late 1940s to finance the reconstruction of the war-ravaged economies of Western Europe. When these nations recovered some measure of economic self-sufficiency, the bank turned its attention to assisting the world's poorer nations, known as developing countries, to which it has since the 1940s loaned more than $330 billion. So there we have the World Bank headquarters in Washington, D.C., and the IMF is also located there.
Yeah, they're on, across the street, one of the streets, the IMF building, from the World Bank in Washington.
The location of Washington, D.C. was disputed at Bretton Woods by the 44 member countries attending.
They didn't want it in Washington,
yeah.
D.C.
They didn't trust us.
We'll do the next one.
Two, the World Bank, Bretton Woods, 1944, free trade. I read from Robotham, page 46 of Good Bye America. Institutions designed to redress trade imbalances, which would have supported the Third World in its efforts to escape from debt, were deliberately omitted at Bretton Woods. Instead, free trade was given the highest priority. So I guess those were the institutions that Keynes wanted to establish.
Right, for balanced trade, yeah.
Yeah. Both the IMF and World Bank had written into their charter the requirements that they promote the free trade of goods and services throughout the world, and through their activities endeavor to remove all restrictions to trade. Countries were placed under no obligation to maintain a balance of trade with other nations, but were permitted to seek a persistent trade surplus. And Robotham, on page 46 again, said, the fate of the Third World was determined before a single loan was issued. Goodbye America, page 46.
Yeah, it was going to be debt, and debt was going to control the Third World. I'll do the next one. The World Bank, Bretton Woods, Third World Debt. And this is from Robotham again. It is worth dispelling one of the great myths about Third World debt, that the poor nations owe money to or are in debt to the rich nations. This is categorically not the case. At least 90% of the $2.3 trillion owed by the poor nations are owed to commercial banks and lending institutions, the World Bank, the IMF. The debts of developing nations record an obligation to banks, not to other countries. And you see the world bankers on the left and the effect of this system on third world children playing in the garbage. It's all a debt to banks and lending institutions. Will, do the next one. Or Anne, I think Anne. Yeah.
The banker's debt money system at work, the world's 60 poorest countries. From 1970 to 2002,
In 1970, they owed
$25 billion, and 2002 owed $523 billion to the IMF and the World Bank, $153 billion, to commercial banks, $370 billion, totaling $523 billion.
So look at the difference of how much more they went into debt. over those 30 years.
They went from 25 billion to 523 billion.
Yeah. And the majority of it was to commercial
banks.
And the other was to the lending, international.
So
lending.
From 1970 to 2002, 550 billion has been paid on 540 billion of loans, and 523 billion debt remains.
Even though they've already paid 550 billion. But it started off. I mean, they've already paid 550 billion on 540 billion.
Yeah.
But because of the interest.
They had to pay interest on all that.
They're still owing practically the same amount.
It's pretty much the same thing, yeah.
Yeah. So they can never get ahead.
You can't. You just get worse off and worse off.
Yeah, yeah.
So if we had a sovereign money system, all this money that was needed could have been done without debt.
Yeah, I mean,
if we had the countries
of the world, right?
Yeah, and they were taking their own money.
Yeah, and you'd have to think through, you know, if we had monetary reform and a sovereign money system in the U.S., how would that affect international money flows?
Mm-hmm.
And how would that affect the IMF? How would that affect the World Bank?
Mm-hmm.
We know how it would affect the international commercial banks based in the U.S. if we had sovereign money,
mm-hmm.
right?
The IMF and World Bank and the commercial banks would be unnecessary.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be necessary. We'll tell them to go get a job.
Tell the bankers?
Yeah, the bankers, go get a job.
Right. Earn your living for a chance.
Yeah, that's what they tell us. They tell us to go get a job.
Yeah.
We'll turn it around on. Okay.
But remember, this is also happening to the developed countries. You know, I mean, we're all the U.S. is in the most debt ever.
Mm-hmm.
Was it $18 trillion of public debt? You know. I'll do the next one. Third world debt is 30 years. So from 1971 to 1998 is this chart. This around 30 years, right? So I picked out some of the countries and the increase in their debt. Right, so Argentina went from 2.3 billion, this is billion now, international debt of major third world borrowers in billions. To 2.3 billion in 1971. In 1998, they owed 133 billion.
Yeah.
Brazil, 3.3 billion to $258 billion. The Republic of South Korea from 2.1 billion to 154 billion. And Mexico from 3.6 billion in 1971 to 153 billion in 1998. So there's no way they can get free of debt, and it just keeps growing and growing and growing.
Mm-hmm.
International debt is the total debt a country owes to foreign creditors. Private commercial banks, international financial institutions such as the IMF and World Bank. Those are the international creditors of the world. I'll do the next one. Number four, the debt money system drives free trade. So the international debt money system is the World Bank, the IMF, and the private commercial banks. We'll do the next one.
Political economist David Ricardo supported free trade. His four conditions make free trade work. In 1817, David Ricardo advanced the theory of comparative advantage, set forth four conditions. One, do not move capital over borders from a high wage to a low-wage country. 2, balance trade between participating countries. 3, trade only between countries with full employment. And 4, open competition, no monopolies or oligopolies. And none of those conditions exist.
None of them exist. And these, the next slides are taken from Don's presentation at the Left Forum. He presented on free trade versus rigged trade. Anne, do the next one.
Okay, this is the World Bank Investor Brief. The World Bank is owned by its member governments. Each government has committed an amount of capital to the bank, but only a small part has been paid in, the remaining being on call. The money loaned by the World Bank is raised by World Bank bonds. Mm-hmm. Capital markets. How much does the World Bank borrow each year? Approximately 30 billion US dollars per year. What are the key components of the World Bank's funding strategy?
Let me just stop here. So this is the investor brief that the World Bank sends out because they want to sell their bonds.
Their bonds, okay.
Okay.
Okay. What are the key components of the World Bank's funding strategy? To meet investor needs by offering a broad product mix and ensure high standards of execution. The funding strategy. What are the main features of the World Bank's debt offerings? The World Bank has been rated AAA for over 50 years. World Bank debt has zero risk weighting, Basel 2 and 3. World Bank bonds have been offered in over 56 different currencies, with a wide variety of maturities as plain vanilla bonds or structured note. Does the World Bank issue liquid global bonds? 1 to 6 billion US dollars in size benchmark maturities, US dollar, euro, and other currencies. World Bank bonds are part of major indices, such as Barclays Capital Global Aggregate, Bank of America Merrill Lynch Global Broad Market, Quasi-Government, and Citigroup World Broad Investment Grade. That's world big.
So these World Bank bonds are sold around the world and in all different currencies, and they're AAA rated by the rating bureaus, which means they're great, there's no risk attached to them, and they're very acceptable.
Part of major indices of all these major financial investment firms.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So
I probably own some of them.
That's probably true.
And all my index funds.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
We don't even know it, but we do own them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'll do the next one. Where does the World Bank get the money to lend to third world nations? Now, you're going to hit enter, Will, one time.
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute.
What happened?
Okay, something disappeared.
Okay, now you're going to hit enter again.
Okay. World Bank sells bonds.
Right, number one. Right, this is where they get the money to loan to third world nations, right? Now hit enter again.
Okay, private commercial banks in rich nations. Bank create debt money and buy bonds.
Goes right back to the banks.
Okay.
Never, hit it again.
3, wait a second. Debt money is loaned to poor nations.
There you go.
And now they're in debt.
That's it. And the money is coming from debt
commercial
money,
banks.
Commercial banks. The whole system is built on the commercial, private commercial bank money.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll do the next one. International Monetary Fund. Hit enter. What does the IMF loan, right? Hit enter again. The SDR, special drawing rights, are an IMF world currency that the IMF creates when it makes loans to poor countries. It is debt money. And you hit again, debt money.
There's debt rises.
Yep. And hit it, debt is a weapon.
Yeah.
It's a weapon for these poor countries and for the wealthy countries too.
It's a weapon used on everybody.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Do the next one, Will.
Okay. Oh, let's see. Money creation debate in the U.S. Parliament. You want to turn him on?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, the first thing is very simple to the market. Makes a loan, it simultaneously creates a matching deposit in the borrower's bank account, thereby creating new money. Many times I've been told that this is ridiculous, even by one employee who previously worked for Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in the United States.
Oh, boy.
Bankers do not know what they did.
They do not know. They do not know is right.
But the ones at the top do.
I'll do the next one. Debt money system drives free trade. To repay their international debts, poor nations must earn dollars. Number one, they compete against other poor nations, all who export similar products, glut the market, and drive down prices. Number two, they compete against the wealthy nations who strive to maximize their exports and minimize imports because they too have massive public and private debts. So everybody's doing
this. It's hopeless.
It's hopeless, yeah. I mean, you know, this is debt slavery is what it is. Yeah. Yeah. And hit enter again, and it says, two times, it says, all nations are in debt and seek not a trade balance, but a trade surplus to export. So everyone's trying to pay their debts by exporting, every country.
Yeah.
Not going to work.
No, it doesn't.
Doesn't work. But I can't help but feel like the people who built this system knew what the effects were going to be. Certainly, Keynes knew what the effect was going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do the next one.
Poor nations are not earning enough money to repay their loans. And so the private banks seize the assets, land, minerals, buildings, and food of the poor nations. Yum, yum, says the international banker.
Yep, they get all the wealth, the real wealth, right? And left, okay.
Yeah.
You want to do the next one?
Okay. Just a second. Today's situation, none of the necessary conditions for free trade to produce mutual benefit apply anywhere in today's world. And those are the ones that Ricardo outlines.
Exactly.
Yeah. Instead all nations try to pursue imbalance of trade where they profit the most. Multinational banks rig trade to their profit at the expense of the third world nations while calling it free trade. This free trade scam has been accepted and promoted by powerful financial and legal world agencies, World Bank, IMF, GATT, WTO, OECD, and the UN, and governments of the strongest nations. So you have up at the top, Detroit plant closed. A guy will work food. Mexico plant closed. Rust Belt plant closed. Detroit, $20 an hour. Mexico, $2 an hour. Indonesia, 20 cents an hour. Vietnam, 2 cents an hour. And there goes the guy with all the money, the private banking system. And slavery is such an ugly word, we prefer the term free trade.
Boy, tell you.
Yeah.
What a world, huh? With this system.
Yeah.
Oof.
It's gotta go.
It's gotta go. I mean, for the sake of mankind, right?
Exactly.
Wow.
There's no way to tinker around with it. It has to go.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the next one.
Okay. World Bank affiliates, 1956, the International Finance Corporation, IFC. The IFC is an affiliate of the World Bank and the only one that invests in private sector projects in developing countries. The IFC management, shareholders, and articles of agreement are independent from the rest of the World Bank group. Its share capital is provided by its 173 member countries, and it raises most of its funds by issuing bonds. You can imagine the commercial banks buying them.
Yeah.
And here's one of their projects, Coca-Cola, right? This is investing in private sector projects in developing countries. And this is called Number 5 by 20. Join the conversation about women's empowerment. Ask questions and follow the conversation. And I just love the Coca-Cola logo, you know.
Yeah.
And on the right is Coke brings 5 by 20 initiative to China to empower women. So, and you can, I don't know Chinese, but you can see the colors of Coke there, right? The red. Must be Coca-Cola in Chinese there somewhere.
And there's some happy women.
Right. Seems to me it's used by the Coca-Cola company to spread its brand around the world.
Yeah.
Wow. Do the next one.
Okay. Let's see if I can get something out of the way here. Okay, the World Bank affiliates, B, 1960, the International Development Association, IDA. The IDA, said Czarlinka, is proudly put forward as the good deeds work of the bank because it makes 35 to 40 years interest-free loans to really poor countries. Member countries replenish its funds through contributions in addition to supplementary funds provided by the World Bank and IFC. Critics say, this is Arlinga says, critics say the IDA was only formed when there was a threat that the United Nations was going to set up its own lending agency, the Special UN Fund, Sun Fund. Eugene Black, president of the World Bank at the time, admitted that the IDA was really an idea to offset urge for Sun Fund. Okay. So they're good deeds.
Good deeds. They're good. Good people.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, they're not.
No, they're not.
Okay. I'll do this one too.
Okay.
This Islamic Monetary Developments, Echoes of Scholasticism. The, as Arlene says, the Old Testament had strong prohibitions against usury. It was slightly ambiguous regarding the practice of usury against non-Jews. But the Quran is very clear that all usury is forbidden. Muhammad, in the Quran, says, Muhammad, God has permitted trade but forbidden usury. Profit is the result of initiative, enterprise, and efficiency, value, creation. Not so with that usury.
No private banking system for Muhammad.
Yeah.
Get out there and work.
Yeah, create value.
I'll do the next one. Muhammad understood the nature of money as a legal creation and taught his followers that nominally valued copper coinage was to be as acceptable as gold and silver, said Zarlanger. And here's from one of the parts of the Quran, I guess. According to Muhammad, the property of currency attaches to circulating fulus or copper coins. They are, in his view, suitable for partnership investment, like all other absolute currencies, like dirham, silver, and dinars, gold. So the tides of Bishop Berkeley in the early 18th century, talking about money as token, as tokens,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yes. So Muhammad understood money.
Yes. Yes. And right. and how it should be used to help the society for everybody.
No wonder we don't like them.
Exactly. Exactly. Get rid of those ideas.
Yeah.
Do the next one.
The Quran forbid the taking of pain of interest, and when the interdiction was first proposed in the 7th century, business flourished. It says Zarlinger. However, by the 11th century, a person conducting commerce in accordance with the law was looked upon as ridiculous by all other merchants. And that was a quote from Abraham L. Yidovich, Partnership and Profit in Medieval Islam, published in 1970.
So here you see on the left Islam at around 750 A.D.,
mm-hmm.
How it spread from Muhammad's Arabia.
Yep.
And then the trade routes on the right that went all through Islam, all the way out to Asia, right? And by the 11th century, the merchants, the businessmen of Islam, according to Abraham Yudovich, and he quoted this other writer, Hurgronje, H-U-R-G-R-O-N-G-E, the Muslims weren't following the law about interest, right?
Well,
you see, that commerce in accordance with the law was looked upon as ridiculous. You know, you follow those laws? We don't do that. You know?
Yeah.
That's the pull of trade and making money, you know, even in Islam, in the history of Islam. Do the next one, Will.
Okay. Muslim countries over the last 2 centuries gradually adopted an interest-based money and banking system under the influence of colonialism. But that is now beginning to change. That's what Zarlinger said. But since the 1930s, there has been an Islamic economic revival. M. Yemer Chopra. Toward a Just Monetary System, published 1985, describes three phases. One, 1930s, reevaluation and reaffirmation of classical Muslim values. 1965 plus, Muslim economists analyzed ideas. 1985 plus, efforts to develop interest-free banking and financial institutions. And then you have the symbol of Aman Islamic Bank. Aman. That's Aman, right? Aman.
Amana? I don't know how they pronounce it.
Yeah. Islamic Bank. No interest, huh?
No interest, right.
But it still seems to be a private bank.
Yes. Right. Well, the NEED Act says banks are still private. It's just that the NEED Act is different because they're still private banks, but the money is debt-free money created by the government. Here, the money, they don't go into who creates the money, but it's interest-free.
Yeah, it's interest-free, but the banks are the one that, I'm sure the banks there are the ones deciding who gets the loans.
Right, and that's still the same under the NEED Act.
Yeah, but they won't be able to create money out of nothing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I bet you here they still create money out of nothing.
Probably. I don't know. Here they're talking about interest and usury and interest.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, there's other banks. You see that they started to create these interest-free banks in the Muslim world. The Mizan Bank and the Islamic Bank. So far, some pictures. I'll do the next one. Principle of Islamic banking. An Islamic bank is based on the Islamic faith and must stay within the limits of Islamic law or the Sharia in all of its actions and deed. Four rules govern investment behavior. The absence of interest-based or riba, interest-based transactions. The avoidance of economic activities involving speculation or ghira. The introduction of an Islamic tax, the qat, which is basically a person offering a certain percentage of his money to poor people.
Okay.
D, the discouragement of the production of goods and services which contradict the value pattern of Islamic haram. Acts that are haram are typically prohibited in the religious texts of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah. And this is the category of haram as the highest status of prohibition. And I don't know examples of it. On January 1st, 1980, approximately 7,000 interest-free counters were opened at all the nationalized commercial banks, making Pakistan the first country in the Muslim world with Islamic banking. So they look like they nationalized their commercial banks.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And that's a night view of Shah Faisal Mosque. The mosque occupies a unique and cultural significance in Pakistan.
Yeah.
And when did we go to war with Pakistan? When was that?
I don't remember. It was after the Russians left.
Maybe around 1980. I don't know.
Could be.
Yeah. Okay, do the next one.
Money and banking with Islam. Right, just to say. Institute of Policy Studies, Islamabad and International Center for Research in Islamic Economics, 1983, reviewed by Madame Hussein, the American University of Cairo. Okay. On September 1977, the President of Pakistan asked the Council of Islamic Ideology to prepare a blueprint of an interest-free economic system. He set a time limit of 3 years for the elimination of interest from the Pakistani economy. Concrete actions had already been taken by the government of Pakistan on the introduction of zakat, and the elimination of interest from the operations of National Investment Trust, the Investment Corporation of Pakistan, and the House Building Finance Corporation. The report is a product of the efforts of a group of dedicated persons specialized in economics, banking, and Sharia. The report consists of an introduction, a conclusion, and five sections. The introduction discusses the nature and rationale of the prohibition of riba in Islam.
And riba is interest? Riba, yes, is interest.
Section one deals exclusively with the practical considerations in applying the profit loss sharing system. Section two discusses the mechanisms for the elimination of interest from the operation of commercial banks. And section three deals with ways and means of eliminating interest from the operations of specialized financial institutions. Section four addresses the role of central banking and monetary policy in an interest-free economy. The last section of the report presents ways and means to eliminate interest from government transactions.
So everything is to eliminate interest.
Yes.
They don't really talk to the creation of money.
But their commercial banks are nationalized.
Yeah, yeah.
So the government would have control over who they loan to and what for.
That's right. That's right. At least in Pakistan here.
Yeah.
If this is still true, this is 1977, 1983. Okay, I'll do the next one.
It is still.
What?
It probably still is true.
Okay. Summary. It is U.S. monetary reform that is needed. Zarlinga says, over time, the IMF degenerated into a strong-arm collection agency for the major banks, applying biased economic theory to maintain the power of the super wealthy. The author suggests, that's Zarlinga, that international reform will follow quickly from U.S. reform. Therefore, reforming our own money system should be the primary focus of Americans desiring a fair international system. And there you see the U.S. and its trading partners.
Yep.
Its top 15 U.S. trade partners. The international trading system. Do the last one, Will.
Because of the dominant position of the United States in the dollar in the international monetary arena, real reform of the U.S. money system would automatically solve many of the most pressing international monetary problems. And then you have the banner of the American Monetary Institute. And the book, The Lost Science of Money, and regarding the difficulties of the unpayable debt burdens of the lesser developed countries, Pope John Paul II is the best economist. Debt forgiveness, plain and simple, makes sense in most of his statements. a Jubilee 2000 correlation.
And that's, and I believe that's it.
That's it.
With money, without control from the public, leads to corruption, usurpation, and slavery. And we can see that very much internationally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.